chick flicks, romantic comedies, rom-coms. You love them, you hate them,
but we are here to eviscerate them. Welcome to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast.
We are your hosts, Eliza Bertrand
and Janelle Walker. Now, let's get on with some feminist joy killing.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our second week of Regency Romance Month. We are so excited to be back into it. This week, we do not have Janelle with us. She has some other things going on, but we have a very capable guest co-host to replace her. Kelsey, say hi to everyone.
Hello, everyone. I'm excited to be here.
This is my very dear friend, Kelsey Fast, who Janelle and I know from college, and who I like to think of as my own personal Jane Austen expert.
That's so much pressure. Don't say that.
Kelsey, can you tell our audience why I think of you as my personal Jane Austen expert?
Sure. So I actually know Janelle because her and I were both literature majors at American University, where we all went to school. And I spent my senior year at college working on a thesis that was trying to figure out writing something about Jane Austen. I love her dearly. I've always loved her works of fiction. It's probably her fault that I decided to waste some money on 4 years of an English literature degree, but but it's paying off 9 years later, getting to talk to you about this. So I'm excited.
Yeah, I mean, your thesis was literally about visual representations of Jane Austen. So I feel like you're ready-made for this discussion.
I am. I spent most of it talking about the 2000 Pride and Prejudice, so I was glad listening to the two of you talk about it, that you also agreed that it is the superior version. So
I knew you were going to be happy about that.
You know, it's not obvious, especially I think when people get so focused when you're a book lover on how does that like translate literally into a film, that would be the right choice. But I think very similarly with this movie that we're going to be talking about, I think there's similar trends. So
yeah, I'm very excited to hear your thoughts on this one. This week, folks, we are talking about yet another classic Jane Austen novel that has been turned into many film adaptations, but we are talking specifically about the most recent one. We are going to be talking about the 2020 Emma, which I had not actually watched until I watched it to talk about this. It's been on my list for 2 years, but I don't know if anyone's noticed, the last 2 years have been a little weird, and I never got around to it, so I'm glad that this gave me an excuse to watch it.
Actually, same. I hadn't seen it at all. I think Emma is not unlike Pride and Prejudice in that it has been adapted many times, so it's easy to get Emma'd out. And so I hadn't watched this one because I also admit Emma hasn't always ever been my favorite Austen. So I think I put it aside, and like you said, we've had some crazy times the last couple of years, so I didn't make it a priority to watch. So
well, you've especially had some crazy times the last couple of years. There's been a small human depending on you for
there
life and
been.
Stuff.
Yes, it's a whole other layer in a pandemic world. So
well, I'm glad you're taking a little time off of mommy duty to come talk to me. Let's jump into it. We're going to start as Janelle normally does. I'll take her job today and read the Google summary for the movie Emma from the year of our Lord 2020. The Google summary is truly terrible for this movie, so I'm going to apologize for that now. It's not even written in full sentences, so we're going to have to fill in a lot of the gaps. It says, following the antics of a young woman, Emma Woodhouse, who lives in Georgian and Regency-era England and occupies herself with matchmaking in sometimes misguided, often meddlesome fashion in the lives of her friends and family. That's it. That's the whole Google summary. It feels like it's the end of a paragraph, but that's what we've got. So that's what Google says this movie is about. Kelsey, my question for you, what's this movie really about?
So, you know, I'll actually say I don't think that the Google summary is that wrong. It's just not very thorough. I think that they capture exactly the essence of Emma, but it takes many readings or watchings to get that level out of the story. But Emma Woodhouse is a young woman who her essentially companion, who if she was younger would probably have been considered a governess, but she's a companion. It starts with her getting married and she's lonely. And so she finds a project friend in Harriet Smith, and she decides that it is her responsibility to improve her. And she does all sorts of meddling and matchmaking to try and pair her off very not well. She does not have good judgment at all. And she is juxtaposed with a family friend, Mr. Knightley. This Emma has a good Mr. Knightley, I will just say. And Mr. Knightley is constantly trying to correct her, give her advice. He's kind of like that brotherly figure in her life, trying to guide her along her way, even though she is terribly misguided. It's also kind of like a mystery. They don't really touch on like the detective. They kind of put people against each other between Emma and Frank Churchill, and who is Frank Churchill, and they don't know who he is. And I'm a little rambly right now, but Frank does enter the scene. She fancies herself very intrigued and maybe in love with him, but then realizes she's not. And she learns many lessons along the way about how very little she can read and understand people. even though she is in her like early 20s, she's probably 20, I think.
Yeah.
She kind of has this like coming of age, like out of her own world and fantasy, and kind of learns what is really going on around her, and becomes very like, I don't know what the right word is, but she's just like, her worldview is challenged, and she actually grows out of it. So I think this is certainly a story of personal growth for her too.
Yeah, I definitely think that of the sort of main protagonists in Jane Austen novels, she's one of the ones who really goes through the most growth. Not that others don't, because obviously a lot of them do, but you know, like as we were talking about last week, the main character being Lizzie, she learns a lot about her interactions with Darcy, but I feel like who Lizzie is at the beginning is who Lizzie is at the end in a lot of ways.
Yep.
And like, that's not true for Emma. She really realizes a lot about like how stuck up she was and how self-centered she was. And she learns a lot that she thought she knew, and it turns out she doesn't.
Yeah.
How did you think that this film handled that? Do you think it showed her growth well?
So, I mean, there's always the classic like turning point for her is always when Mrs. Elton demands that she wants to see Donwell Abbey, where Mr. Knightley lives. And so they arrange for a party and they go to Box Hill, and Emma has kind of a poor altercation with the character Mrs. Bates, who's kind of the Miss Bates, who's kind of the busybody around town and can't stop talking to save her life. And Emma is very cruel to her. And I think that every time I watch it, it's always like any adaptation. It's how will this be depicted in this version, and how will Emma react? How will it be acted, right? How will Mr. Knightley kind of chastise her? Mm-hmm. They all do very similar things. I think they use a lot of the language from the novel, and that helps a lot. And I think this one, just watching her carriage like drive away and the immediate tears, like that to me felt like this very genuine, all of a sudden, like emotional outburst from her. And she's not really that emotional of a character. So I think that turning point, you see, you really do see a change. And then the way I actually liked how they did, some of the adaptations on film haven't shown like her actually speaking to Miss Bates after. A lot of times, like I think it's the Gwyneth Paltrow one, they like shut the door or run away when Emma tries to call on them the next day. And this one, she actually has like a discussion with Miss Bates following the incident. And I think the following reaction, where she gets back to Hartfield and Mr. Knightley's there talking to Mr. Woodhouse, right? She definitely seems more chastened. And I think I think they do a good job with it. It's in comparison to others, you know, they all seem to do a similar thing. But I do think you see a period of growth for her after that. And this one I don't know, I haven't watched the Gwyneth Paltrow one in a long time, but it feels like it moves faster. All of a sudden at the Harriet is like injured and being rescued soon after this, and Frank Churchill and the whole love triangle that starts to happen there between Harriet and Knightley and Emma that doesn't exist between Harriet, but just that her feelings, that it's all of a sudden, it's so abrupt. I think the one thing I could say about this is you slightly lose a little bit of the Emma growth, but they quickly get you to the romance piece, right? Like, Emma's realizing out of this, simultaneous to the fact that she's recognizing, I'm a poor judge of character outside in the world. I've also, I don't even know anything about myself. And I'm discovering that I love this man who's been in my life for forever. And it's very new, I think, feelings for her.
Yeah, I have to say, I agree with you. I think the movie does have a few pacing issues. I think the beginning felt a little slow to me, and then I really liked the speed at the middle, and then it kind of sped up at the end. Yeah. So I think they could have spread out sort of where they told parts of the story a little bit better. But I did also really like the altercation with Miss Bates and that whole sequence. I think that that was one of the strongest parts of the movie. And I think one of the things, you know, you were talking about the scene where she has the emotional breakdown afterwards, where she's like really shamed. I think that worked so well because this movie in particular is very stylized. It's very sort of hyper realistic, and it's a little like everything's a little bit bigger and brighter and colorful, and the characters are all a little sort of cartoony versions of themselves, which is fun. And it's obviously like a very distinct directorial choice. But I think the moments that are the most that are acted with the most sort of realism are that moment when she has the altercation, and then it is like the most awkward, cringeworthy silence from everyone afterwards. Yeah. And then she has a very real feeling fight with Knightley about it, and then has the breakdown in the carriage. And in comparison to the sort of staccato stylization of the acting in and filmmaking in the rest of the movie, that really hits home because it's so much more genuine feeling. And I think that pacing wise that worked really well, because it does kind of like halt the movie to a short stop when it's been going at this sort of goofy level up until that moment. And then, you know, the interaction where she goes to apologize, I thought was really lovely, you know. So I think that really used the style of the movie to its best advantage. But yeah, I think then after that, then it's like, okay, let's get to the romance, like,
yeah.
Like, we need to like jump onto that. And then suddenly it's like she's realizing she's in love with Knightley, and she has the, you know, incorrect realization that Harriet is, you know, in love with, like that's when all of the sort of complicated, almost sort of Shakespearean comedy of errors romance starts happening. And that's one of the fun things about Emma, right? Like, Emma's sort of notorious for being a book that doesn't have a plot, right? Like, there's not actually a lot of stuff that happens other than just sort of Emma's perception of the world changes every few weeks.
Yeah.
You know, she's like, oh, this character is in love with this person. And then she's like, oh, no, they're not. Never mind. And like, that's the big action. It's not really that anything else has changed. So you do get this sort of bed trick, you know, mixing around of all the different possible couples. And you kind of get throughout the movie and throughout the book that sort of like, will these two end up together? Will these two end up together? And I think the movie really goes hard with that in the second half, which I almost wish there was a little bit more of earlier on. But I really enjoyed it once it got into the weeds of that.
But I feel like this version, you can tell me what you think, paid less attention to Frank Churchill as a plot point. You know, like, I think the buildup in other versions spent more time with him as like, who is Frank Churchill? He's ignoring his father and not coming to visit. He keeps putting it off and putting it off. And so the almost like the buildup to meet him feels less weighty. And then once he's there, you have, there's, it feels like less interaction between, and less chemistry. Maybe it's just that they don't really have chemistry. Maybe that's what it is. Like, I feel like the other versions between the actors that played Emma and Frank Churchill had quite a bit of chemistry that you could believe that Frank was trying to, like, use Emma as a distraction to his real love interest of Jane Fairfax, right? And
I agree.
And I didn't catch that same, like, tension. Which made it less, it felt like there was less at stake, I guess, with that relationship. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I think that the Frank Churchill, Jane Fairfax drama felt like it happened a little too off screen. One, I wasn't particularly impressed with their characterization of Jane Fairfax. Like, I mean, so much of it is about Emma being jealous of her just because she's jealous about anyone else getting attention. But you kind of want her to show up and be very impressive and be beautiful and social and, you know, and whatever. And there's that moment where she's really good at the piano. But other than that, I felt like she was just sort of standing in the background of all these scenes. And I wanted her to be an object of jealousy for Emma in a much more tangible way. And then for there to be that tension with what's going on with Frank Churchill and Emma's drawn to Frank Churchill. And I also think that for me, at least, I've always sort of, I like it when Emma and Frank being drawn to each other means that that's sort of the moment when Knightley maybe doesn't realize that he has feelings for Emma, but starts really feeling his feelings for Emma. You know, right? Like, that's the moment where he's like, well, up till now, I haven't had to act on my feelings for Emma because there haven't been any other possible suitors, so it hasn't mattered. And suddenly he's like, shit, she's gonna marry this guy I don't like. Now I'm jealous, damn it. Like, there was a moment or two of that, but I didn't feel like there was a lot of reason for him to be jealous. It was more just like the actor acted it well, but there wasn't enough stakes to really make him feel that way, where you were like, well, he's gonna have to step up and say something now because otherwise she's gonna marry Frank.
Yeah,
I never really felt that way watching this version.
Yeah, I agree. You only really get like one like piece of it when which I actually loved this bit, but they had their dance at the inn, the Crown. They do their party late into the night. That's like also the first time I will say you've seen like the end of a party where you can assume that they went until like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, right?
Yeah.
And then they go home afterwards. I don't think I've ever seen any Austin do that, any adaptation on film do that, where you get that sense. And so seeing like Knightley, this Knightley is so dramatic to me. I just feel like he really feels his feelings more out there than any other adaptation of Knightley at all, because he like runs all the way from the inn to Emma's house to assume like he's gonna propose love. Like you think he's gonna be like, I love you, and then through your crazy series of events, right, whatchamacallit is there, Frank is there, and you're like, why are you here? And it's very strange. And they don't know who should go. And there's a lot of the little what's going on situation. I guess I messed that up. That is where Harriet hurts herself. It's not later.
Yeah. That's where Harriet,
Harriet
has the altercation with the gypsies.
Yes. Yes. The gypsies come in.
A small book detail that doesn't, I would say, really hold up these days, but
yeah,
it's there.
It's there. It's fine. But they didn't really show it, so I guess that makes it a little bit better than other adaptations, which
although more confusing, where you're like, she had what now?
I know, very strange. On your way home at 5 o'clock in the morning after a ball?
Like, what just happened?
Strange.
But anyway. Hilarity ensues.
It's very funny, but it's like that first time that, you know, Emma's like, no, wait, stay. And then you can see like the jealousy play across Knightley's face when she doesn't mean him. That right afterwards, you know, he goes home, like lays down on the ground or whatever, and he's just like, oh my gosh, like I love her, what the heck.
That was great. My little romance loving heart really enjoyed that entire sequence of him like running to her and then running home and like ripping off his tie because he just needed to breathe.
Yeah,
it was very dramatic, but I enjoyed it.
I did enjoy it. He really is the most dramatic of all of them, and I did really like it. Austin's writing is so reserved. And so I think that tends to play out in film. And I think that's the strength of some of these newer adaptations that aren't done by the BBC, but have that like Hollywood lilt, right? They have to kind of gain an audience that they kind of need to over-dramatize to show the viewer or the reader, like, if you didn't catch this, like, this could be a feeling, you know, the Brits are very reserved people generally, but they do have feelings. And I think seeing that play out on screen is really, really fun. So,
yeah, I feel like this is not your mom's Jane Austen, right?
No.
Like this is very, I feel like there's a trend lately of these sort of more dramatic, more emotional, more over the top kind of period pieces. This is how you get your Bridgertons.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I don't mind it when it's done well. And so I think that this movie decides to take that trend and do it in a way that's like has a directorial purpose and, you know, is more focused and there's like a reason for it. You know, the costumes are really over the top, but they're all like actually pretty historically accurate. Their details are very particular. You know, it's not just big to be big. It's big for reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So I think letting Knightley be a bigger, more dramatic character, like it works.
Yeah,
I don't have a problem with it, but it's not the 90s, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow, Emma. Like, that's not what we're watching here.
Yeah, yeah. Which, honestly, that one is more, I would say, that version feels, like, witty, right? It's very smart, and there's lots of, I don't know, just the, I think the writing on that one, probably because it follows the writing of Austin very closely.
Mm-hmm.
I think it does have that, like, this is witty comedy versus I'm going to throw my body around in a like dramatic comedic way to convey the love that I feel. And I like both. And I think this one tries to do both, but it does feel much more dramatic and kind of showing that comedy through physicality than some of the dialogue.
Yeah, this is a very physical movie. And the movie, honestly, it is filmed like a comedy. You know, we have this conversation a lot on the podcast about like, just because it's a romance doesn't mean it's a rom-com, right? And there's so many things that, like, technically fall into the rom-com category but aren't really comedies. And, like, this movie is a comedy. It's got
comedic,
like, music. It's got comedic, you know, sound effect beats. The editing is comedic. It's acted very comedically. And, like, that's great. But I do think it loses a little bit of the more sort of biting social commentary satire side of it. And it gets the bed trick satire comedy part of it. So I think there's a bit of a trade-off, one for the other.
Although I will say that I really loved that they had Bill Nye come in and be Mr. Woodhouse, the crazy hypochondriac, who in every other adaptation is very subdued. He's not, it's sort of funny, right, that he is always afraid of everybody getting sick, but they really play that up. And I think they did it because they had him that could do that well. And the opening, like, just the whole beginning of the movie, he's just so like, poor Mrs. Weston, like, or poor Miss Taylor, poor Miss Taylor. And I love the one of the first scene that you meet Mr. Knightley, when he goes to their house, he's like, did you feel a chill? And and they, like, move the screen and, like, block him so they can't see. And you've got the, I think, just the funniest expressions from, you know, the footmen who are moving the screen, just like, seriously, this again. And they, it's just, they use it there. They use it later. And it's really great later.
It pays off really well because they set it up as this, like, stupid physical comedy bit. And then at the end, it, like, he purposely does it where he has them move the giant screen in front of him in order to give Emma and Knightley a moment privacy. Alone, which is, like, that's, like, such a nice detail. It's really fun. I enjoyed that. And it, like, for a father character who's so sort of goofy, to give him that one moment where he was still being his eccentric self, but also, like, a little bit more sort of in the know and, like, doing a little thing. Yeah, being aware of what's going on and doing a little thing for his daughter. Like, I thought that was a nice detail. And, of course, Bill Nye pulled it off, like, so well.
He's probably my favorite Mr. Woodhouse, but I think, to your point earlier, right, the whole movie kind of feels that way. And it does, I think, lose some of that, like, Austin wit and, like, what she's doing and what she is able to capture in the book, when what she's capable of writing. And you kind of, I think what film loses with that, right, you know, I was doing some, like, prep work for this and just remembering a little bit more about the novel itself. And she writes Emma in, and it's one of the first instances, I think she's the first one to really do it, of free and direct style, which is really, like, that is when the story is written in the third person. But as a reader, you are only really getting Emma's mind, and you're following and you believe her, and you're getting those, like, thoughts and her expressions as a character. And she only deviates in the book once from following Emma to following Knightley for, like, a chapter. And that's where you kind of get I think that's where you can kind of pull in film off of, like, oh, he really loves her. And how do you, like, make this obvious? Because that's when she focuses in on him. That style of writing, right, you have to approach as a reader with a very, like, critical lens, because you have to recognize, even though it's being narrated to you, you're getting lost in Emma's thoughts and her perspective. So you have to be able to, and this is why I think Emma takes a couple of readings, right, to really kind of get a sense of what's going on and pick up on some of these things that are easier. You can convey them in film really well, because you can kind of, and using comedy helps to show the ridiculousness of the situation. And you can see body language, and it's very different, but you're, as a reader on the outside looking in on this story, you have to be critical of Emma and also recognize that Jane Austen's probably making fun of you too. Like, there's a little bit of that going on and a little bit of that at play.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, like, one of the things that's so interesting about Emma is that it's very specifically really about, like, a single town, a single sort of area. And I think they're in Kent. Is that right? Wherever it is, in the countryside.
Yep.
And it's all about, these are basically all neighbors, right? Like, they have a social circle, but because they're all close to each other and they can get between their houses very well, and they all, like, go to the same church and they all, you know, shop in the same town. And even for Austin, a lot of these characters are quite poor, right? Like, this is not, they're not all gentlemen's and gentlemen's wives and daughters. Like, there's, you know, one of the main love interests is a farmer, and Miss Bates and Mrs. Bates, although they seem to have come from wealth, are boarders in town. Right. They're, like, boarding in a boarding house. And then Harriet is a orphan and or a natural born daughter, meaning mm-hmm. bastard child, who's going to a basically a school for orphaned girls, right? Mm-hmm. Like, these are not all well-to-do people, but they're all just high enough up that they merit some sort of place in the society of this region, of this neighborhood. And that also then really has a lot to do with Emma, because Emma is one of the wealthiest and most sort of genteel of the people within this social group. And so even though she's the youngest, she has a lot of sort of political power over them, mm-hmm. You know, in a social circle kind of way. And so when she's messing with everyone's lives, I think it's really important that she's messing with the lives of people who have less power than she does, which is one of the reasons why Knightley has to keep chastising her. Like, he's like, this is fun for you, but these are real people's lives and you're fucking with them.
Right.
You know, when she denies Harriet the ability to get married to a good solid man, even if he's not very high up in the social circle or very wealthy, she's denying Harriet the opportunity to have stability. Right. And she needs Knightley to really point that out. And I did feel like this movie doesn't do a great job of really laying out the economic and social status of everyone.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, you know that Harriet is a kid who is having, you know, she's at the school, they talk about her being natural born. But, like, other than that, I feel like they didn't do as good of a job of being like, here's who has wealth and power, and here's who doesn't, and here's who has the ability to make a decision in the social group, and here's who just has to follow along. Because the book is so much about all of those machinations, as well as just, like, what's going on in Emma's head.
I actually wrote down while I was watching, I love that they pulled this out for Knightley. He says to her, better to be without sense than to misapply it as you do. And I think that exactly summarizes exactly what you're just saying, right? It's Emma is smart, and she should understand these things. She should recognize, I have this role in the small society of our little town. And people rely on me and I and my father and the social standing we have. And I go around and I give baskets and I'm trying to be, you know, a good patron of the folks in our little village. But I am, in fact, uprooting people's lives and playing games that I don't have any business playing in because my judgment is compromised. Mm-hmm. And I think that's such a great point about Harriet, too, because she really does, like, she really has no business making friends with Harriet. And I think Knightley and Mrs. Weston have a whole conversation about it, because, like, I don't think this is good for either of them. It's not good for Emma because we have no idea who she is. And it's not good for Harriet because she has this capability to be exactly, like, she's in the right situation for everything we know about her, and she has good friends, and she has a man who loves her, and Emma's just completely elevating her sense of, and not that it's a bad thing to feel good about yourself, right? But that sense of, like, worth and what society could mm-hmm. offer her, she puts it too high on a pedestal, so that when Harriet comes crashing down, when they have the discussion about Knightley and the fact that she loves Knightley, but Emma also realizes she loves Knightley and all the feelings are hurt, right? That's Emma's fault. It's her own fault mm-hmm. that happens because she decided to become friends with Harriet in the first place and do all of that and mess in the love lives. And poor Mr. Martin. My goodness.
Mr. Martin, who didn't do anything to deserve this.
No. Just caught up in the crosshairs.
He just, like, gets to know this nice girl who's friends with his sisters, and he thinks, I could marry her, she'd be great. And then he just has to wait for 8 months while she, like, figures out her shit.
And falls in love with two other men.
Right. Who are, like, progressively more out of her league, too.
Yes.
Right? Because, that's the thing, is that, like, Emma keeps saying to Harriet, like, you know, I know that you're pretty low on the totem pole, but, like, you're smart and you're educated and you're pretty. And so, like, I think that you could probably reach for higher than, you know, than just, like, strictly your standing. But by the time she ends up falling for Knightley, like, Knightley is laughably out of her league. He's the wealthiest character in the entire book. He has a huge estate with a ton of land. He's the older brother, right? So, like, everything came to him, you know, and like, he is just not going to marry some, like, girl with no last name who goes to the local, like, Christian boarding school. Like, that is just not gonna happen. And she's now convinced Harriet that, like, she could reach for the stars on that level, which is genuinely a disservice to her. And luckily, like, Harriet's actually perfectly happy marrying Martin, who she fell for in the beginning, so, like, it works out, but it really is precarious there for a minute.
Yeah, that poor man. And, you know, poor Mr. Knightley, too, because he thought that he was doing a good thing, doing something very similar, trying to matchmake a little bit on his own at the beginning, helping him write a nice letter, And Emma's just like, oh no.
Right, like he's also trying
to, obviously written by his sister. So silly.
Right, but I also feel like his relationship to Martin is so significantly different than Emma's relationship to anyone sort of at the beginning. Emma has that line where she's like, oh, well, he's not actually poor enough to be of interest to me, right?
Right.
And like, so the people who are very poor and she can like genuinely give charity to, she's interested in. And the people who are in her social circle, she's interested in. And everyone else just doesn't hold interest to her. Mm-hmm. But for Knightley, Martin's one of the actual farmers on his property, right? Like he's one of his tenant farmers. And so it's important to him that Martin is a hard worker, that he's a stand-up guy, that he's taking care of his sisters, that he does things in the proper way when he's proposing to this young woman, right? Because like Knightley's in charge of him and responsible for him and his land.
Well, and wants to see him succeed too. There's like his success means Knightley's success. So he needs him to do well. And he kind of has that almost in a, it's a different relationship because it's more like, it's more like brother to brother, I think, but he kind of takes on that like older brother role a little bit, helping coach and guide him along. And he does something very similar with Emma, but Emma is not really up for coaching. So until she realizes that she actually does love him and appreciates the perspective that he brings to her life. Right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because like there's nothing technically inappropriate about them marrying. It's just that they have developed this relationship, which is seen as familial.
Right. Well, and they are connected through family, right? Because his younger brother married her older sister. So there is that that family connection there that brought them even closer than what may have been there before, when it could have been, you know, Knightley just coming to visit Mr. Woodhouse. But their, you know, their family estates are so near each other that it doesn't surprise you that they would have been, you know, Mr. Woodhouse was probably friends with their father. And so that relationship just continued. And they did probably, even though Emma is significantly younger than him. Although you can't tell this, they do. They definitely, the actor, I forget his name, Johnny Flynn, maybe, that kind of goes opposite Anya Taylor-Joy. They don't look very off in age.
Yeah, so I just don't think that they worked very hard to like make Knightley look a lot older than her.
Yeah.
But one thing that I think that they worked very hard on is making all of the men's collars very tall.
Yes, they were very tall. And Knightley's sideburn action was very aggressive.
Sideburns and the like collars up to their cheekbones. Like there's just a lot happening on the side of his face.
Oh my goodness. It was the first when you first see him and he's like coming back from wherever he was and he needs to take a bath and they're getting redressed so he can go see Knightley. Also, I'm very surprised, see Mr. Woodhouse rather. I'm very surprised though that he wasn't at the wedding.
Yeah.
So that was odd to me. I would have thought that Knightley would have been at the wedding, but so who knows where he was, probably off doing some sort of business. But then you see a little, you know, Knightley butt action, and then all of a sudden he's being dressed, and then you're like, what is going on with the hair on your face, dude? Can we like take that back? I don't think anybody else has such aggressive sideburns going on. So,
you know, I think they were trying to do something with him being sort of always very stiff and proper, so that in that moment when he returns to the house and he like rips off his, you know, open his shirt collar and his rips off his tie and lays down, that you're supposed to sort of see him unravel for the first time. Yeah. But I feel like they could have accomplished that without making him look like so ridiculous to start with.
I think he grows on you, you know, the more that you see him like play out the character. At first I was like, oh my, he is not the Knightley that I enjoy from the Gwyneth Paltrow version, which the actor's name is escaping my mind. Who is that actor? He's my favorite Knightley. He still probably is. Jeremy Northam, thank you. My mother would be embarrassed.
Jeremy Northam.
My mother would be embarrassed. I'm sorry, Mom. But Jeremy Northam, he has always been my favorite Knightley. And I think this one, and he's just instantly, you know, he kind of, his handsomeness doesn't have to grow on you for you to like him. He's just like in your face hot. And not that Johnny Flynn isn't hot, but I think it's a sort of like a building, like you kind of have to pay attention. Like you're like, okay.
Yeah. You know, when the trailers for this came out, I was like, oh, like Knightley's not hot. That's too bad. And by the end of the movie, I was like, oh, I'm so into their romantic chemistry. But I think it did take some time. And I think his acting was very attractive. So that like then brought me back to it. But I don't like the way they made him look.
Yeah.
Which like is not what it's supposed to be about, but it is what it's about. So like, sorry.
It's Jane Austen. It's, they have to be hot. Like, I don't know. They just, you need to like them right off the bat. But
Well, and it's so interesting because in a movie, in a story where you don't actually necessarily like the lead right off the bat, to then also not necessarily like her romantic
interest,
you know, interest right off the bat. Like, there's a lot of you having to warm up to the characters in this.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's intentional because it is Emma and they want you to have to kind of work at it, or if maybe there's something they could have done a little bit to make you on board from the start.
Yeah. Emma's such an interesting character. Herself, you know, when I was prepping to talk to you about this, I did totally intend to fully read a biography on Jane Austen because I've wanted to do that for forever. And I actually haven't. So a lot of the things I know about her are kind of bits and pieces of her life and more focused around her novel writing than her whole life story. Mm-hmm. But even with Emma is the last novel that was published before her death. And when it came out and when it was in process, you know, a lot of family and friends kind of read it, and people in her social circle, which weren't that many. But it was very interesting to kind of skip ahead a little bit into this book that I was reading to see what they talked about with Emma, because it's not surprising, actually. You know, Jane Austen has famously said that she didn't think that anybody would like the character of Emma, and that she was only really appealing to her as the author. And I think that's pretty evident with how the novel itself was received. A lot of people totally hated it. Mm-hmm. A lot of people really loved it. She was worried that it wouldn't be kind of taken the same as Pride and Prejudice. Pride and Prejudice kind of still stands as one of her most popular, I think. Pride and Prejudice, I think, is easy to digest in mm-hmm. its social commentary and the romance and the story that's playing out, where Emma's a little bit more complicated, and you are, as a reader, kind of being made fun of the whole time that you're reading it. And Emma herself is not a reliable storyteller. So it is a challenge, but Austen's really doing something new, and she's very innovative in her storytelling, and she pretty much every one of her novels does something different. None of them are the same. They have different goals and what she's trying to do, and as she's writing, she's learning. And Emma's published when she is 40, later in her life, and I think she's learned a lot from when she first wrote, you know, Sense and Sensibility and Pride and Prejudice in her early life, even though they were published later, but she wrote them when she was pretty young. So it's just so interesting to see that, like, this is there were two others, Persuasion and Northanger Abbey, were published after she died. But this one was like the last one that she published while she was alive. So she kind of got to see how the world around her received it. Which is really interesting to me.
Well, it's so interesting to think about her age and how it affects her writing, because I feel like in some of the early ones, you get the very sort of like Jane Austen trope of the old busybody lady. Mm-hmm. You know, you get your Mrs. Bennet, you get in Sense and Sensibility, you've got Mrs. Palmer and Mrs. Jennings, right? And they're just sort of like, all they do all day is mess with young people's love lives. Mm-hmm. And then in this book, you get a young busybody who's sort of flighty and silly and incorrect. And the older, annoying character in Miss Bates is actually written quite sympathetically by the end.
Yes, yeah.
And there's definitely something interesting going on there of her maybe gaining a little perspective that, you know, not all of the young women are smarter and better than their mothers and their aunts. Like, maybe they have something to learn from them.
Yes. Oh, that's so funny. I didn't pick up on that, but it's probably so true. She got a little older. She has young nieces and nephews of her own, and she's just like, oh, they're so dumb. That's probably what she's thinking.
Like, I feel like so much of, like, Pride and Prejudice is Jane Austen rolling her eyes at Mrs. Bennet, and so much of Emma is Jane Austen rolling her eyes at Emma.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
Very different.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, but she has a fondness for her, right? I think she sees... I think there's probably a little bit of, like, I can see some of myself in her arrogance, because she is arrogant. She thinks she knows exactly what she thinks. Her judgment is so, you know, pure, and she's perfect in it, and she's not. She totally we haven't even talked about the Eltons and the Mr. Elton situation, but she totally misjudges that entire thing. And she's, her brother-in-law tries to warn her, and she's like, no. Like, she just, like, totally.
Like, she's like, I'm right, you're wrong, like, obviously.
Obviously, I know what I'm doing, and I know what I'm talking about.
And she couldn't be more wrong.
Oh, my gosh. So wrong. I actually loved the comedy of that when they're at the dinner, and they find out her sister and brother-in-law are in town. Mr. Elton is there. They're having, and you can totally, it's so obvious. And a lot of this I felt very, even though it was slow, like we were talking about earlier, the timing, it did feel very rushed how you all of a sudden got to this moment with Mr. Elton. And I haven't watched the other adaptations in so long, so it could just be just my own misremembering of the others. Mm-hmm. But it does feel like it comes on faster. And all of a sudden, they're just like, oh, it's supposed to snow, or it's beginning to snow, or something. They're like, what? It's snowing? We have to leave. And you that get that. Great. Just, you know, Mr. Woodhouse and Isabella just like freaking out. And it's the first, I think you get a little bit more characterization there of like Isabella. I actually love that dynamic between like her and John Knightley and the arguing and bickering. It's so funny. It really is. It really is funny. And I appreciate that. I think we did talk a little bit about that earlier, but just I don't mind that they take that extra comedic tilt in some of these mm-hmm. instances where they do it with characters, I think, that don't get a lot of screen time or like in other adaptations. So all of a sudden it's just like, here's a different perspective on mm-hmm. on these people that you really don't pay attention to. And the story's not really about them, but it gives you that extra dynamic of, okay, this is what Emma has. She's lived with ridiculous people her whole mm-hmm. life. And she's had to be, they talk a little bit about how like after her mother died and just how much she's changed since then. And she kind of takes on, she is so much more like her mother than like her father and sister. And I think that that piece, it's just an extra like juxtaposition, right? Like, this is who Emma is versus the family that she lives in, but she still loves them and she cares for them deeply. And she can't possibly imagine moving out of her father's house. And Mr. Knightley is okay with living in their home. And that's it's just like so sweet. There's so much sweetness there in their relationship. That's very different, I think, than some of the other romantic characters mm-hmm. in Austen's novels.
Yeah, I think they definitely captured, like, for as ridiculous as Emma can be, she cares about her father and she's very beholden to him, and like she's the one who's taking care of him. And that's one of the things that I think Knightley sees that helps him to fall for her, right? Like, he sees these moments where she is practical and kind and thoughtful. And I thought that this movie definitely covered those parts of it really well. And on that note, I guess maybe let's just wrap this up with, this is a love story. And as we're talking about through our whole Regency miniseries that we're doing, these are love stories that we still read constantly mm-hmm. and we still remake constantly. Why is it, do you think, that people still connect to these stories? Why are we still talking about Emma 200 years later?
Oh my gosh. You know, I had a feeling you'd ask this question. And I honestly, it made me go back and remember, like, when was the Regency era, right? Like, it's such a short period of time. And it's really just this one. And honestly, like, you know, funny little tidbit, Jane Austen did actually dedicate Emma to the Prince Regent. which I think is just hilarious that happened, because it feels like this is like quintessential. It's almost like this is quintessential like Regency because of that. But I think it's, and Austen's not the only one. And there's so much different storytelling happening during this time frame too. You know, Frankenstein mm-hmm. was published in the Regency era. And so you have, but people love these stories. And I think the period itself, it was such this extravagant, like beautiful time. People were spending a lot of money and society was in this peak of parties and just being beautiful. It just is beautiful. I don't have another word for it. Mm-hmm. Which is why I think when we talk about different stories, it's so easy, even now, you know, it's not just stories like Bridgerton, but people constantly retell stories that take place in that era, because the society itself was almost like, it was in this like rigidity and structure that was also like bursting at the seams. And so it's easy to imagine that some of that bursting at the seams was like lusting men and women who mm-hmm. couldn't control themselves.
outside of like Austen's, you know, just like satire on the time. And I think, and her stories are also, they're so smart, yeah. and they are real social commentary of kind of what's happening in the world around her. And you have, even in that extravagance, it's actually really interesting. She doesn't spend a lot of time in the extravagance that Bridgerton has spent mm-hmm. so much time in, right? Like she's focused more on what she knows and her experience in the gentry class. And her father was a clergyman. So she was kind of in, considered in that level. And I think that's her experience. And so she spent so much time there. But even that, there's such a dichotomy of wealth mm-hmm. between, you know, the folks that were in the gentry versus the aristocracy versus, you know, like merchants and farmers and the peasantry, right? And so I think she does a great job of showing that difference that you don't necessarily see, but people are also just fascinated by England, I think. I think that time, we mm-hmm. in America, we're in a very different place historically as a new country, yeah. just like coming out and finding our footing and figuring out our own governing documents. And England was like, heck, we lost the war. Let's go spend some money. Our king is crazy. So like, it's just so like strange, which is ironic because they got out of the war and gave up because they were spending so much money. So I think it's just, it's a strange period of time for them. But it is so fascinating to watch from the outside. And I think it's a fun place to spend time to retell and find new ways of telling romance and imagining what people were experiencing. People love historical fiction of any kind mm-hmm. because I think it taps into that. What was life like? Even if you're telling me a fictional story that probably doesn't match what life was like, which is why I think Austen's novel have stood the test of time, because they are kind of a pinpoint. She gives you so much of that societal mm-hmm. commentary, so you can get a view into the world, even though it's difficult to understand. And especially if you didn't grow up in England, it was even harder to understand and takes a little bit more thinking and learning to really get what she's telling you. But I think it's just fun.
I think you're totally right about, you know, she gives us such a detailed look at such a very specific point. I think that, like, as someone who loves historical fiction and history in general, it's always great when you have really specific details. And I think that people gravitate towards that in her books, right? Like, mm-hmm. we can know exactly what it felt like to be one of those people because here's all this information about it. And it's, like, about such a specific group of people at such a specific time, but it's so interesting and fun to, yeah. like, deep dive into it. Okay, so this is the part of the show where we take a moment to thank all of our sponsors on Patreon, particularly our romantic leads, who are Ian, Melissa, Bob, and Esther. We love you guys. Thank you for letting us keep talking about Jane Austen and these movies, because it's so much fun. You can join us on Patreon and become a part of the Romcom Killjoys family by going to patreon.com/romcomkilljoys. You can join for as little as $1 a month and help us to keep making this. So thank you to all of you. All right, now, Kelsey, as yes. you know, this is the part of the show where we wrap things up and provide little antidotes and or supplements. If like us, you liked Emma, here are some supplements for what you can do next. Kelsey, what have you got for us?
All right. So being the big Jane Austen fan that I am, I gravitate towards any sort of reimagining of her work. So I'm going to recommend two video series that you can find on YouTube. One is an actual Emma adaptation called Emma Approved, and the other is The Lizzie Bennet Diaries. These were yes. a video series. They were both done. Lizzie Bennet Diaries was done 10 years ago, which thanks, Eliza, for reminding me about that. And it is a lovely, probably, I don't know, 60, 70, there was so many videos of them just retelling the story of Pride and Prejudice. It was very successful on YouTube, and they won an Emmy for it. And they took that and did Emma Approves, which is another very similar style of storytelling, kind of like a video blog, where the characters of Emma and Lizzie
are portrayed in different respects. So it's very, they're both just lovely. So if you're looking for a different way of experiencing Jane Austen in great detail, but with a modern twist, I highly recommend both of those.
I definitely second that recommendation. You know, Kelsey, how much I love Lizzie Bennett Diaries. And Emma approved as well. They're really fun. And they're like very of the moment, you know, it was sort of mid-2010s. And they really sort of captured that kind of YouTuber video blog style, but also do a really good job of adapting the stories that they are. Well, for me, I also was thinking of a modern adaptation to recommend. We've actually already covered this previously on the podcast, but I truly do believe that Clueless is one of the best possible Emma adaptations. I think it's so good. Every time I watch a like set in the right time period Emma adaptation, I end up thinking about Clueless and what a good adaptation it is. I think that they really capture that kind of like person who has wealth and privilege and power and is smart and caring, but is just so naive that they make misstep after misstep after misstep. And I think it does a really good job of modernizing the story in a way that helps you to understand it, especially for the Jane Austen, which is often one of the ones that's a little more difficult for people to get into. So yeah, I always think it's time for a Clueless rewatch. So that's my recommendation this week.
I totally agree with that recommendation too. It's a good one and a good podcast episode to listen to after you watch the movie.
Aw, thanks, Kels.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, yeah, so go watch all of that. Go watch Emma. Go watch the older Emmas too. We love the Gwyneth Paltrow one. Go read Emma. And come in back next week to hear what we're going to talk about next time. So, Kelsey, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you. This was so great. So fun. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
If you'd like to support us further, you can become a patron at patreon.com/romcomkilljoys.
Our theme song is Lady Slut Hitchhike Love by the band A Giant Dog, and the song you're listening to now is a cover of Baby Love by Colin Langaness.
Remember, Killjoys, don't let anyone kill your joy.
Not a rom-com, not us,
not anyone.
See you next time.
Instead of breaking up, it starts and kissing in me.